Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Sari McCree, and I'm Vice President of Corporate Relations at Allstate. On behalf of Allstate, I want to thank the Aspen Institute, the Atlantic, and most of all of you for supporting this important discussion on competing globally by reforming American education. Earlier this week, our Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Tom Wilson, participated on a panel titled Preparing Our Nation's Workforce, along with Secretary Gutierrez, Secretary Spellings, Harman International Executive Chairman Sidney Harman, and Rockefeller Foundation President Judy Rodin. And as you would expect, there was a wide spectrum of topics discussed at this panel. But the topic of improving education dominated the dialogue. And while there was consensus on the need to improve education to ensure global competitiveness, the core question regarding how to accomplish this superordinate goal remained unanswered. And it remained unanswered because this is a complex issue with wide ramifications, yet it demands attention and focus. At Allstate, we believe the public and private sectors need to work together to help find solutions to this issue. And we need to act quickly, because after all, today's students are tomorrow's workforce. So the question remains, what should we do? How can we reform American education? We're very pleased today to have a distinguished panel with us today to discuss this issue and help us move from dialogue to action. Our moderator today is Andy Rotherman, a co-founder and co-director of the Education Sector. It's a national education think tank. Andy also authors the blog eduwonk.com, one of the most widely read blogs on education today. He serves on the Virginia Board of Education and a number of advisory boards and commissions, including the National Charter of School Research Project. Andy?
Thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's great to be here. This is a really important issue, and I think what you're going to see today is there's really general agreement that schools need to do better, in some cases much better. For instance, Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, is here with us, where they're really facing some serious challenges to improve their schools. Other places, you have schools that need to do marginally better, substantially better. But I think you're also going to see there's a lot of disagreement and different views on sort of what they need to do differently, how they need to get better, and so forth, and how it relates to this competitive challenge. And we really have a terrific panel to get into this, and I'm going to briefly introduce them and then let them introduce themselves. And I'll start down at the end. Gina Burkhart runs Learning Point Associates, which is a national organization that provides services for states and for school districts. Under her leadership, it's grown from a small $6 million venture to a $40 million venture serving states, not only concentrating in the Great Lakes region, but actually serving and doing work around the country and nationally. Bill Schmidt is a professor at Michigan State University. He's probably the leading expert, near and dear to Mr. Broad's heart. He's probably the leading expert on sort of looking at different countries, looking at their standards, looking at how U.S. students compare to other countries and what those countries are doing. He was particularly instrumental in the TIMSS, the Third International Mathematics and Science Study, which really launched, I would say, the current round of debate around looking at some of these international comparisons and bore a lot of fruit. Eli Broad is the founder of two Fortune 100 companies. That's something no one else has ever done. Now he and his wife, Edith, who's with us, have turned their attention to philanthropy. They focus, in addition to education, where they are doing quite a bit of very generous giving around school system management and leadership, they also focus on the arts and medicine. And Howard Gardner is probably best known for his theory of multiple intelligences and the work he's done on that, but he also works on a variety and thinks and writes about a variety of education issues. He's a professor at Harvard University in his day job, but his reach and influence in American education goes much beyond that. So before we sort of get into all the substance, and I'll just start with you, Howard, we've got different perspectives and the panel is put together differently. So where you stand depends a little bit on where you sit. So I'm going to ask each of them just to say a little bit about sort of where they sit and how they come at this.
Well, as you mentioned, my work was initially in the area of intelligence. I came at it as a psychologist because that's been the area that's looked at most at intelligence, but I found somewhat to my surprise that educators were much more interested in what I had to say than psychologists. So for the last 20 years, I've spent a lot of time thinking about American education, what's gone wrong, what could go better, and I know all of these people's works to some extent. What I have to say, and I'll provide a lot more context later if time allows, is I don't particularly like the question that was posed because I don't think that global competitiveness, particularly in the area of science, mathematics, and so on, are the major things that we should be thinking about in our country today. And I'm just going to put forth two propositions. Proposition number one is, what kind of a country do we want to have? I think we're a country which has been fantastic historically, not without problems. It's been innovative. It's given people second chances. Best stuff that's happened has happened voluntarily. And the notion that somehow we should improve schools rather than change the direction of our country, I find very problematic. And let me give just a very, very brief example. 25 years ago, everybody went crazy about Japan because they had the best test scores and the best education. And people said we had to go become like Japan. Japan went in a total funk for 15 years, mainly while our country, you know, was in excellent economic shape. So the relationship between education and how the country is doing is, I think, tenuous. The second point I want to make is the big work in education now is scaling up. And the idea, which is a good one, is if there's something good happening somewhere, it ought to happen more widely. What I feel the genius of America is that we should scale up bottom up. Which means when something interesting is happening, people should have a chance to look at it. If they feel motivated to do the same thing, they should be helped to do it, rather than top-down, everybody must do this, whether it's a No Child Left Behind mandate or focusing on STEM subjects, science, technology, education, engineering, and math. I think those things don't work in America. So to summarize, I think this is an issue about America. It's a Tom Friedman kind of issue. How do we, in a flat world, become cooler and less crowded, and not how do we raise our scores or have a one-size-fits-all approach for the country.
Eli, from where you come from as a former leader in business, a leader in philanthropy, and how do you view the problem?
I agree with many of the things we just heard. However, I do believe that we have to dramatically change and revamp our public education system in America. 40 years ago, we were number one in high school graduation rates. We're now 21 amongst industrialized nations. There are many things we have to do, starting with more learning time. Our children are shortchanged. They get 30% less learning time than they do in other nations. In other nations, they have a second shift called homework. Our kids go home. And they spent 5 to 7 hours in video games and watching TV. We need better teaching. Other nations get their best and brightest to go into teaching. We get the bottom of the barrel, other than Teach for America. We've got to offer incentives for superior schools and superior teachers. We've got to offer differential pay for math and science teachers. We need a national curriculum, in my view, at least in math and science. And I could go on and on.
I think we'll come back to the national curriculum point. But as someone who's looked at countries with different kinds of curriculum and so forth, I'm going to want to hear from Bill on that. But first, how do you look at this problem in terms of the work you do, Bill? Especially some of the work you do. You do a great deal of work now in China and so forth. How do you see the competitiveness problem to the extent that you believe it exists?
Well, I come at this as a statistician. I'm trained as a statistician with an undergraduate degree in mathematics. Basically, I think that this global competitiveness may be an overstatement of it, and unfortunately, in a lot of this, the focus tends to be on the achievement results, and so people compare the various countries and then think that's the most important thing to learn. I think what's most important, and we've studied that quite extensively, especially in the TIMSS work, is to look at what it is that other countries do in the process called schooling. And what we see there is that there's a great deal of difference in the nature of the expectations that different schools, different countries have for their students. Put simply, in other countries, what it is that's taught, the content, which is actually the focus of schooling. I mean, schooling is about transmitting the knowledge, skills, reasoning that's necessary to be a functioning member of society, as well as to get a job. And so, therefore, those are the important things. Well, that's where schooling meets that's the nub of schooling. And when you look across the world, you see that that varies quite appreciably. Surely everybody teaches math, everybody teaches science. But the nature of how it's put together, what's taught at which grade levels, all of that is very different across the world. And just briefly, in the rest of the world, it's very focused. They concentrate on a small number of topics, cover them well. It's very coherently organized, structured, so topics follow logically. And it's also demanding, rigorous. Eighth grade is about, in the rest of the world, it's about algebra, geometry, physics, and chemistry. In the United States, it's about arithmetic and rocks and body parts. It's a very big difference in terms of what the expectations are for these children to learn. And I think that's what's come out, that's the part that comes out of this work that I think really speaks to the heart of what you pose, which is, why are things the way they are? We've relate in our book I've done, Why Schools Matter. The answer to that is because of the expectations and the content exposures that they give to their children. And I'll stop there for now.
That's great. Gina, you're out there. You're working with educators. You're working with state officials and so forth in a very sort of direct, supportive way. Sort of what are you seeing both in terms of the nature of the challenge and what are some of the roadblocks?
I think it's pretty clear to everybody in the room that our system is fairly dysfunctional, especially for our kids of poverty and color. And so the problem is pretty well laid out there. We're not achieving at the level we ought to be. But why doesn't our system, actually where there's been lots of money pumped into it, why does it stay entrenched in its dysfunctionality and not move to reform? And I think if we look at how innovation actually moves through a system and why education as a system is so opposed or not accepting of innovation, we can see why some of the brilliant things you're going to hear from my colleagues don't ever really get implemented in the trenches where we have to be making things change and be different. So I'm happy to talk about that.
So do we need more centralization?
No, absolutely not. I think if you look at how innovation plays out in businesses or in industry, it's about communication, it's about interactivity, it's about collaboration between scientists and practitioners and intermediaries. And you don't find the same kind of isolation that you find in education institutions. So the welcoming of innovation isn't there. We've got to open up, we've got to provide more opportunity for innovation and more social interaction.
Can I respond to that? I think at the level at which you're speaking, I agree with you with what you mean by centralization.
But I didn't say centralization.
Well, he did.
He did.
Asked the question. And I would just like to take a different take on this, and that is if you look at the nature of our system as you've described it, it's not a system. There are 15,000 of those things. Sure. They're called local school districts. Sure. It is absolutely ludicrous in today's world that 15,000 versions of mathematics should exist or 15,000 versions of anything. It's partly the problem we have is because there is no central direction for the system. We're a highly mobile society. Kids move around. They can end up moving from one school to another and miss huge parts of their knowledge base that they need. And mathematics and science is very hierarchical. You can't miss the middle chunk and then get the next piece in any sensible fashion. So I think, and I support you on this, that I do think we need national, not federal, national standards that specify what it is that all children should learn. And it doesn't cramp the creativity. It doesn't prevent people to do things differently. But it allows for a common, equal base for all children.
For the audience, though, what's the difference between national and federal standards? I'm sure there's a lot of people.
Okay, federal means the federal government. And I think the federal government probably doesn't belong in this or things will get totally messed up. But I think national means that we could have an organization, I believe, created by the governors that would be simply a standing national body. We already have that. We have the National Governing Board for NAEP, mm-hmm. which is called NAGB, which is an independently created organization that sits over the national assessment. That's what I mean by national.
But President Clinton tried that. The first President Bush tried that. President Clinton obviously was a former governor himself, was very active. They didn't get very far. How have the politics of this issue changed? Because, I mean, you can say on the one hand, you know, if you build it, they will come. But if based on some of the things Gina said in her analysis, you might also say if it's purely voluntary, you will build it and no one will come. And Eli, you want to respond to that? Because you're doing a great deal of work on that.
I agree. You cannot have 15,000 school boards made up of political wannabes, well-meaning parents, people representing a labor organization competing with national education ministries. You've got to empower governors. You've got to empower big city mayors. In big cities across America, the only time I've seen change is when you have mayors either run the schools without a school board or have an appointed board, whether it's New York, Chicago, most recently Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. Or if you go bankrupt, as Philadelphia did, as Oakland, California did, or if you have Katrina, which is the equivalent of bankruptcy, in New Orleans. We can't just keep going with this fractured system of 15,000 school boards. We need strong American standards. They should be national, I agree. You can't have a kid in one state getting 4 years of math in high school, another state 2 years. It doesn't make any sense. We are one nation. State borders don't mean anything anymore. We're competing with other nations. So I think we've got to change the structure of American public education. It's easy to talk about and very tough to do. But I think today, more than ever before, governors and big city mayors get it. This was not the case 10 or 20 years ago.
Howard? Yeah, I am not going to defend 15,000 different math curricula. But I think the United States is fundamentally a different country from, say, Finland or Singapore, two countries where it is possible, for many historical and cultural reasons, to have a unitary system. I used to joke, it's a little bit less appropriate today than it was yesterday, that you could never come up with a system in America that would please the three Jessies, namely Jesse Helm, Jesse Ventura, and Jesse Jackson. And what's amazing is our college system is universally admired, even though there are no national or federal standards there. So what do I actually think? I sent Andy a paper on this. I think we have at least three quite different systems in America with three quite different sets of problems. One of them is the inner cities, and there I think the problem is excellence, and I defer to the people here who have the primary focus there. The second is what I will call the heartland, which, because I come from Boston, I will call Kansas. But the heartland exists all over. And the other problem is engagement. Kids go through the motions. There is more graduation. But they're not very excited about school, and they don't have this thing that we need now. I think we all agree that learning is lifelong. It's not something that stops when you get your high school or college diploma. The problem with our kids, assuming we're all pretty middle and upper middle class, is ethics, and I'm not going to go into this here because it's a different issue, but it's knowing the right thing and doing it. Too many of them are hell-bent on a certain kind of success with a sense of responsibility, the kind of thing we heard about today in social entrepreneurship, not really infecting our kids as much as it ought to. What do I see as a solution? I think the country ought to have about 12 different pathways from K to 12, with curricula and assessment built in. And the nice thing about 12, it's a manageable number, is you could move from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine, and you would be assumed you would have the same pathway available. Why do we need more than one? Because of the Jesse problem. I frankly do not want to send my kids to a school or a system where the kind of my view of science and math is totally different from what the nation has prescribed. For me, science is learning to think a certain way, which you need in your own life, understanding the difference between creationism and something which is a matter of evidence and observation. And I frankly don't trust in our country with its politicization that there would be a system that I would agree with. So I would do the easy thing, which most of us do. I'd send our kids to an independent school. But if there are 12 things people want to go to the Edie Hirsch kind of school, fine, let them. People who want to go to a Dewey kind of school, let them. And with 12, we can have enough of a surveillance in the country that there isn't going to be any abuse. But I don't want a lowest common denominator, and I don't want a denominator which I don't feel that I would want to have for my own kids.
In a system like that, how do we ensure quality? Because I don't know if we have 12, but We have multiple pathways now, and people essentially choose them either by exercising private choice for people with means, exercising residential choice in terms of where they choose to live, and then you have low-income Americans who have very little choice in education, so take what they're given. You have sort of, you know, as we've talked about, vast quality problems. So in a system like this, I mean, you've heard a powerful argument here from some of your colleagues about sort of the need for quality, the need for rigor. In a system like this, without having some sort of coercive accountability system, like the one that we're all, you know, you hear about No Child Left Behind and so forth, how do we ensure quality in a system like
that? I don't think there's any problem in ensuring quality with 12 systems if we take it seriously, but 15,000 is obviously nonsense. In the inner city, I'd love to hear people here. I mean, I think it's illusory, let's face it, to think that most people in the inner city are going to be going to MIT and Caltech. We want to find those who can to go there, but it's not going to be the same probability as if they're in Newton or if they're in Silicon Valley.
I think we have to parse your argument here about 12 tracks or whatever. I mean, and let me answer your...
Not tracks, but pathways.
That's pathways, but that becomes tracks, and I'll explain in a second. You know, to answer your first question, there are many countries in the world that do this, and Germany recently has joined this. For a long time, Germany was like us. It was a federal system, and they didn't have them. They've now set national standards. And you look across the world, you have to ask, why are we so unique that we cannot do what virtually every other country does, which is to set a set of standards in place that articulates what it is to be learned at each grade level? It doesn't restrict creativity. It doesn't. It's not about the various isms of, you know, I can't think of those. Europe has lots of isms, different approaches to education. It's about what you need to teach and the sequence in which you teach it. And the problem, the consequence of a system like that is the huge inequality that exists within the American educational system. We don't have national standards. Therefore, what transpires is kids in different states are not held to the same content knowledge at different grade levels. Kids in different districts are not. And when you look at the relationship there, you find that the districts that have the higher standards are the ones with the higher social class parents. So we're creating a huge inequality in our system as a consequence. I mean, everybody says, we can't do this. I would like to suggest another way of looking at it. What are the consequences of our not doing it?
And I want to come back to that. I want to follow up, though, on something Howard just said. I want to make sure I heard it right. Did you say that you're not going to have as many kids going into math and science in the urban communities as you are in some more affluent communities? I want to make sure.
Yes, because the amount of, and I think here there wouldn't be any agreement, the amount of social capital that you have available with tutors and individual classes and so on is just incommensurate. I'm certainly not saying that in a John Rawls world where you randomly took people and, you know, gave them different kinds of social capital that you'd have that outcome. But, you know, you can't undo history and culture simply by fiat. I think Bill...
But not by fiat, yeah. But what about by public... It's sort of just showing where we sit. I do public policy. I'm basically I'm known as being a blogger, but I'm actually a policy analyst in real life. Is this something we can fix through policy? Not by fiat, but is this something
Something where I think I would agree with what Eli was saying. I think the two most important things to do would be, number one, to have much better preschool education, and number two, have career paths for teachers of quality who could stay in. I love Teach for America, and I would love Teach for America kids to stay in. I think those are two most important things. I think in some states they're moving toward that, and those are policy things which I think can make a difference. Will they erase the difference in the three systems in one generation, no, but maybe in five generations, yes.
Because we do have something of a natural experiment happening in a lot of cities where you have new schools opening. So, for instance, in L.A., Green Dot Public Schools, mm-hmm. something that Eli's been active in, or KIPP, which is a national network. Richard Barth, the CEO there, is a Aspen fellow for the Ideas Festival. And what's happening there and why it's a natural experiment is these kids aren't, it's not some sort of Rawlsian system. It's not, they're not changing parents, not changing neighborhoods. They're just changing schools.
And just one sentence here.
And they're doing better.
That's what I meant by bottom-up reform. If something is going well in Los Angeles or in Connecticut, let other people, it's the same thing we're doing with health care now. Let other people go there and say, we want to do it, and don't say, oh, it worked in California, we're now going to mandate in the country. It won't work.
Eli?
Let me say several things. First thing I want to say is we need public school choice. What do I mean? If we could provide useful and understandable data to all parents not just middle-class and upper-middle-class parents. We have found they will make some good choices if they're given choices between various public schools, which may have some of the characteristics you've talked about, or public charter schools. Secondly, we've got a big job in America. The American people don't get it. They do not understand that we've got a very major problem in public education. I'll give you an example. Joel Klein has over 1 million students in New York City. He sent out questionnaires to all the parents. He got 400,000 back. 92% said their children were getting a good or excellent education. There's so much to do. I'm convinced the job can get done. There are all sorts of other things happening in New York City. You know Roland Fryer at Harvard. Roland Fryer is he's a tenured economics professor, African-American, 28 years of age? In New York City, he concluded that children are not getting parental support, that children of middle-income parents. He's giving financial rewards, and it's working. He's also doing a number of other things. In fact, he's going ahead with a program that hopefully will be announced soon of an innovation lab. Those are the things we have to have happening. We cannot have a city like Detroit with a 28% graduation rate, major other cities in America with a 50% graduation rate. And the other thing we have to do, which may tie into what you've said, is we have to realize that all children are not going to go to college regardless of what we do. So when they reach the 8th or 9th grade, what do? They drop out. Why? We do not give them a path to a job. And there are certain jobs you cannot outsource, whether it's auto mechanics, electrical work, plumbing, work at utility companies and the like. We've got to end up having 21st century vocational ed for kids that aren't going to college, even though we'd like them all to go.
If I agree with you, my wife's going to get angry, but I actually agree with that.
You've looked at the sequence in terms of the curriculum and dropping out. Do you want to, I mean, sort of, do we need, these kids who are getting into 8th and 9th grade, is there sort of, I think we all agree not everyone is going to go to college, and college isn't for everybody, but are they dropping, is there any sort of randomness, or does this have a lot to do with just how we sequence curriculum, and so that by the time these kids get to 8th or 9th grade, school's a very alien place, because it's a very literacy-based curriculum, and they just haven't had that instruction, aren't able to participate.
It's actually worse than that. Given one of the practices we have in this country, which is tracking in the middle grades, especially in math and science, children are given a certain destiny by being placed in a certain track, which means they're given, for many kids, especially in the urban settings, especially the lower SES kids, are given a much less lower track of mathematics and science. Now, I want to back up for 1 second, because I think we may not disagree as much if you get below a certain point. There are different approaches, and good things happen in certain places, and that's wonderful. I would never think that any of this national business should have anything to do with the nature of how things are taught or the approaches one takes, but the basic knowledge that kids need to have. And I don't think you'd argue that certain kids, just because they are poorer, shouldn't get the same opportunities. This country is a land of opportunity. We believe in the level playing field. We believe kids should have a shot up. If we don't give them the tools... Secondly, I'm not arguing that every kid has to be a math science major, but there's two kinds of languages in school, and both of them are really critical. One is English, you know, basic human literacy we talk. The other one is quantitative literacy. That's what I'm talking about. That's what other countries do so much better than we do. So that when kids get to about 8th grade, they've had a very deep understanding quantitatively of how you think and how you reason. And Eli knows this, the world has changed, the nature of jobs have changed. That's much more relevant now than it ever was. And I simply argue that all children should have that opportunity. To your last question, if that's not provided along the way, they get to a certain point and they're shut out of all those courses that lead to anything of the future. Basically, by the tracking that we do, we preclude certain children from taking certain courses in high school, which then preclude the things they can do in college, which preclude certain jobs. No one believes every kid should go to college. But what I believe is every kid should have the basic foundations of good literacy in that, I don't know what the word would be, in the English sense, and literacy from a quantitative point of view, so that they can reason and function that way. That's what I think is what I'm talking about. And we don't need 12 tracks. The first 8 years should be the same for all children. Why should we differentiate? Why do we believe certain children should have something different than another?
Pathways, not tracks.
That's okay. I'll buy your term. That's the first 8 years. Now, in high school, I'm with you. There's pathways, whatever you want to call them. Not everybody's going the same way. But if they don't have that foundation up through eight, see, that's what Europe and Asia does. They're so well, by the time at eighth grade, they're 2 years ahead of us. This is data from the study. Mm-hmm. 2 years ahead of us, not in achievement. 2 years ahead of us in what they've studied. So therefore, our high school, the first couple years, is considered catch-up. So that college, somebody said our colleges are good. That's only partly true. The first 2 years of college in the rest of the world is viewed as being catch-up to high school. And so therefore, it's only toward the end of high school and our graduate schools that get that reputation. And all I'm arguing for is if we make this level, this playing field a little bit more level, all these kids will at least have a shot. Isn't that the American dream? Isn't that what it means to be, you know, for all?
Well, let me pick up on that, because something that interests me is if we need more mathematicians, we need more scientists, where exactly are they going to come from? Because we have a theory right now in national policy that the problem is inducements. So we offer scholarships and so forth, for kids who can make those choices because they've had that education, and they're not making those choices. I mean, you just look around this room. People who have choices choose a variety of careers. The arts and the humanities appeal to them more, the liberal arts, different things. And so if we truly need more mathematicians and scientists in our society, if you buy the STEM analysis, where are they going to come from but for the populations who are chronically underserving right now in public schools? Gina, you're dying to get in, and then Howard.
Well, I'd like to actually take this in a little different place so you can come back to this. I don't think anyone here in the audience, and raise your hand if you disagree that all kids shouldn't have the opportunity to learn. And raise your hand if you...
The same opportunities.
The same. Okay, raise your hand if you think they shouldn't have the same opportunity to learn. Let's see. Anybody? Anybody? But let's also see if there's anyone in the audience that doesn't have a pretty strong opinion about education because you've been there. You went to school, you've had kids that go in school, and you think you know pretty much what it needs to what we need to do to change education. Also, whether or not you like to admit that it's a system, it is an education system. It may be completely dysfunctional, and it may have 15,000 districts, but unless we start deciding that we need to figure out how to move reform through the system, we're never going to get any place. You can pump lots of money, and certain foundations and others have, and we make a difference in 2% of the population. And this year, 10 million kids did not graduate who should have graduated from high school, right? Ask Corey, what do your schools look like? The schools that I work in Chicago, they don't have doors on the bathroom. They don't have toilet paper in the bathroom stalls. The teachers have to pay for their own materials when they come in. One parent showed up for orientation night the first day of school. The theme in my elementary school, don't shoot people. That's their back-to-school theme. So given that as the basis, tell me how we then go to the place quickly, and we're not going to get there quickly, unless we figure out where we tap some innovation into these education systems. And I listened to Dana
Boyd
today talk about digital media and how our kids are learning. And it gives me so much optimism and hope. And then I hear people in the audience push back and say, but those kids can't spell. Those kids aren't really learning how to read. Those kids are doing things in a way we didn't do them when we were growing up. I hope they win. Honestly, I hope they win. Because I hope that the system changes. Because when they're in our position, they're not going to settle for the same kind of education we're willing to give our kids of poverty and our kids of color. It's not okay.
Howard.
I wanted to go back to your question, Andy, about where are the scientists and inventors and technologists going to come from. And I want to give two politically incorrect answers, realizing the TV is here, but I'm old enough that and I'm not running for office. Number one, education has never been very good in America. In fact, well, it just hasn't been compared to Western Europe, for example, and even equaling the numbers. The energy in this country had come from it's been a place that people wanted to be. And, you know, we have more Nobel Prizes, but most of them come from people who were immigrants, whose parents were immigrants. And one of the things of putting borders on here is we're choking ourselves, and even some of our own scientists are going elsewhere because of the number of constraints put on us. So when I said the kind of country we are, that's really what I had in mind, people who want to be here and want to be able to use their minds, brains freely to do what they want. Number two, and I've written about this, so again, I can't deny it, the rewards now for people are not to go into science. It's hard. The rewards now are for people who leave college, my college, and they go to work for Goldman Sachs or they go to work for D.E. Shaw, investment banking, hedge funds, organizational management. And, you know, there's kind of a condescension. Oh, you're going to go to graduate school for 10 years and then you're going to make, you know, $55,000. And you know that now? The average age for a beginning R01 grant in NIH, this is a grant that you can apply for yourself, is age 43. And nowadays, only 10% of people even get the grants. So when I say it's about the country, we have to open our borders and change our priorities. And while I want as much as anybody for every kid to have a chance, how could anybody say differently? I'm trying to look at this in a kind of a macroscopic way, and I have a feeling that over the last 25 years, we've been doing a lot of rearranging of deck chairs. And I hope that Joel Klein makes a difference in New York and people elsewhere, but we don't know yet. We just don't know. 82% of the parents said they liked, no, 92% of the parents said they liked the teachers. Well, we always know. Everybody likes their own teachers and their own doctors. 82% of the teachers said they were alienated. What do we pay attention to? We read the same data, right?
Let me pick up and then ask a question. I want to get some questions from the audience. Sort of the counter thesis to this entire competitiveness issue, you started to touch on it, and you can make a very credible argument that, in fact, the American public school system, you know, has never sort of been the engine driving the economy, and so it's not to blame for our economic problems, nor is it to be praised for economic successes, that instead it's some more basic things, you know, liberal democratic government, we respect contracts and property rights.
Extracurricular activities will be a tremendous amount.
Liberal immigration policies, trade policies, things like that, and that, in fact, sort of putting this on the schools is an unfair burden, that there's really other reasons, and Bill talked about some of them, and Gina, and everybody has talked about them, that just in terms of a more equitable society, a more just society, is really the reason to be improving schools, not this competitiveness issue.
Well, we have to understand the world has changed. With the world of free trade, with the world of technology and the internet, the years we finally think about, we're a manufacturing nation. We no longer are. We can't compete. And in our education system, if you go into a classroom today and say, how is it different than 100 years ago? I think the major change, instead of a blackboard, you got a whiteboard with a marker pen. I don't see technology being used in any way whatsoever to teach kids. I think our ed schools in America are really doing us a total disservice. If it was up to me, I'd have teachers start as English majors, math majors, science majors, and convince them to go into teaching as a good profession at the end of your sophomore, beginning of junior year, and then teach them pedagogy.
You want to say a bit about the Broad Leadership Institute?
Because that's sure. Really.
And do you want to speak up for the ed schools?
Not particularly.
Neither do I.
Okay. 9 years ago, when we got involved in education, we said, we don't know anything about curriculum or how to teach English, math, or whatever. I want to look at things from the top down. I want to look at governance, and I want to look at management. And what we saw in governance was appalling. We attended many school board meetings, read minutes of what happens at school board meetings, and it was rare to find student achievement ever even discussed. So then we said, well, if governance is so bad, maybe we ought to look at management. So we went to interview many superintendents. And for the most part, what we found is they start as a teacher or coach, and without any training whatsoever in management, labor relations, communications, systems, finance, all of a sudden they're running enterprises, $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion, $2 billion, and so we were appalled. There were a couple exceptions. And those exceptions were mostly people that did not start as teachers. So we created, one, the Broad Academy to train school district superintendents. And we have trained more than any entity in America, many more than Harvard or UT Texas and elsewhere. Then about 5 years ago, I said, you know what? I don't see any bright people that have MBAs or similar degrees in school management or administration. So we created something called a residency. And we didn't know how we do, but the number of MBAs with 5, 6, 7 years experience were looking for something else out of life. And the number of applicants we had the first year was 400, and we chose 13. This last year, we chose, I think, 30 out of 30. Like 1,400. Arnie Duncan in Chicago now has 17 of our people. Joel Klein, who has 13. Paul Vallis, New Orleans, half a dozen, so on and so forth. So we hope if you have quality governance, quality management, all the things we want to see happen will happen. It will not happen with the type of school boards we've had in the past, the type of superintendents we've had in the past, and the type of people that we've had what I call at cabinet-level positions. So we're trying to change all that. And at the same time, we've seen a dramatic growth in Teach for America. We've seen a dramatic growth in charter schools, starting with TIP Academy, which now has 60-some-odd schools across America. And I think it's all starting to make a difference. We've seen changes in collective bargaining agreements. New York City now has incentive compensation. Denver has incentive compensation. Stay tuned to what's happening in Washington, D.C. with Mayor Adrian Fenty and his new young 37-year-old Chancellor, Michelle Wray. Washington, D.C. was spending more money than any urban school district in America and probably had amongst the worst systems. I think dramatic change is taking place in a few spots. And I hope all the things I've mentioned will, in fact, make a difference. The biggest problem I still have is a fractured system, 15,000 school boards. Every state has different tests, and they dumb down the tests to meet No Child Left Behind or some other standard so they look good. And we know when you compare them to the NAEP, we know dramatic differences.
That's the national education.
That's a national assessment of educational performance, which is isn't federal, as you pointed out, it's national. We need a lot of changes in all of these areas, and we need it fast.
You asked about the ed schools before. Eli Broad is having a lot of effect on ed schools. Right. They are paying attention to what you're doing, and that itself is
not
is
enough.
Interesting.
Well, at Harvard, you guys are considering a leadership
degree. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And could I add some data?
We're learning from this.
Could I add some data on the very issue of teacher preparation? Because we actually have just completed and are in the process of doing a much more extensive study of teacher preparation across 6 countries. The new study is across 20 countries and includes the elementary as well as the high school. The first one, it was just the middle school teachers. And, you know, what we found is the countries whose kids perform well in middle school have teachers that are prepared extremely, it's what you said, they are prepared well in mathematics. These people have what is the equivalent in this country would be a major in mathematics. That's how they're all prepared. But that's not enough. That's the interesting finding from the study. What we also found is those countries, like Germany, has that same preparation, but their kids don't do that well. The difference is that not only do they have a very strong preparation in mathematics, they also have a good practical preparation related to how it is you take that mathematics and bring it to children in the classroom. So it's not rocket science. I mean, they do better than we do, so much more so, because they have a curriculum that's coherent, focused, and rigorous, and they have teachers who understand the mathematics well enough to bring it to the kids. And that's what I think, you know, to your last point, that's what I think we have to head for. It's not trying to make everything uniform, but it's that we need simply to put these kinds of standards in place to give these kids a shot in this society.
I'm hearing two tensions. One is sort of a theory of change tension, sort of not to deglib, let 1,000 flowers bloom, or 12 flowers, as it were,
okay.
And from the bottom. And another, and Gina talked about this at the beginning, sort of, that we have to be more directive and so forth, and you need more national involvement. And then the sort of second tension I'm hearing is technocratic solutions, so better tests, national standards, these things. But you also still have the politics. And so Eli's exactly right that there's an incentive for states to dumb down tests so they look good. It becomes an exercise in PR rather than educating children. But how does that incentive go away nationally? That's politics. And so sort of, that wouldn't happen in a state with a political culture where citizens wouldn't stand for it, but it happens all around the country. So how do we prevent that from simply happening nationally? In other words, how do we, by going to a more national centralized system, just not recreate these pathologies in another venue?
I have a technocratic solution, and that is that every year or two you actually change the format of the test. So then there's no way to game the test. And every time that's happened in cities, you see the scores go back down again. That's why NAEP is very important. Bill is right. I don't disagree at all that the basic literacies, reading and numeracy, belong to everybody, and that ought to happen by eighth grade. We're totally in agreement there. If we added the stipulation that we change the nature of the test, there are ways of doing this in alignment. I think that would be great. I think where we begin to disagree, science, history. Seth Goodman, are you here? Sean. This is a man. Can we call on him? Talk about what you went into when you try to teach history.
If we're talking about keeping the content in history and making sure that that's a strong focus, the rigor, that kind of thing, but at the same time, we want to teach critical thinking skills and we want to make sure that we're able to perform, we're having a challenge finding. I think we're having a challenge. Is this on?
Hello.
Yeah. Hi. I think we're just having a challenge finding a way to address all the different needs within the classroom across the board. When I have kids who are coming to me from Mexico or El Salvador, and yet I'm also teaching kids of the highest affluency, both in the same classroom, one of the problems I find is funding. I was also at the presentation this morning about media and the use of media in the classroom, and I thought some of the ideas were really great, and I want to try to use those, but at the same time, I'm trying to say, okay, is content still going to fit into some of these new concepts, these new ideas, and how are we going to balance that out?
Gina?
So there's a group right now called the P21 Partnership that is now has about 7 states as membership, and they're looking at exactly that question. And the dilemma that they're wrestling with is content versus skills rather than content plus skills. So it's what you talked about. How do you instill knowledge around content but also give kids their skills around global awareness, critical thinking, team working, reasoning? And what they're running into in their states is, number one, the bureaucracy of changing standards. So the one state that has actually done it is West Virginia, which is kind of an amazing story, where they've now got both content standards and these 21st century skills, and they're embedding them into the curriculum as it's taught K-12 and in the teacher education program. So it's something to really look at. But the pushback in a lot of the states is, number one, they believe they're already doing it, so they don't really see the political need to change. And my question to Eli then is, so the governance and the change you're looking at is at the district level, which is commendable and great. But a lot of the compliance issues come from the state and the feds. So many of these states are really afraid because changing their standards or neglecting the compliance kinds of issues around NCLB, and it gets worse when you get into the classroom with teachers thinking they have to make AYP. So how do we move
annual
governance?
Year progress.
Yeah, adequate yearly progress for all your students. How do we change or push the governance to a different place or a better place? Where
look, it's got to start at the state level.
State education agencies are...
Well, there's some governors that get it. I'll give you a great example. Louisiana, New Orleans was the most financially and morally corrupt school district in America. It got wiped out. You've got a young governor, Bobby Jindal, 37 years of age. He's got a new, very impressive Secretary of Education. They moved Paul Vallis down there. He reinvented the system.
And they have the best data system going. Have you looked at it?
They do. He was formerly Pasternak, I believe his name.
Right, right.
Was formerly, I think, general counsel of NASA.
That's right.
Louisiana, as a result of Katrina, might become the number one state in the nation when it comes to educating kids, believe it or not.
But yeah. I think the word might is very important. There are so many success stories of superintendents just before they move. And if you took a look at the 50 states in America over the last 50 years, on any objective measure, the amount of wiggle is very little. Probably North Carolina has moved because there's a research triangle. But other than that, it's very hard to move things. And I mean, what I was saying to Eli is I think sometimes provocations are very good. But if you happen to see where we are at the end of the day, and it's been very, very difficult.
Well, I mean, the thing, Eli's story, it seems to me, is both an optimistic one and a cautious one. I'm very excited about a lot of the things that are happening down in Louisiana. And there really has been. There's an incredible amount of energy and young people pouring in to teach and so forth. But there was obviously a tremendous tragedy as a precipitating event to that. And so how do you, sort of in terms of the politics, it strikes me as a cautionary tale that how do you, in a state where you just have a stable political system, no sort of impetus to changes, how do you bring about that kind of broad change?
I'd like to respond to that in one sense. I've had the opportunity, a wonderful opportunity, to speak to the nation's governors on numerous occasions. The Hunt Institute is a great vehicle for bringing these governors together. And I'm really fairly optimistic. I'm sort of optimistic anyway, but I think genuinely optimistic here. The governors seem to get this. They really seem to begin to understand this issue, and they're willing to move. And I think there's less political stuff goes on there. When they sit together, I've noticed Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, it really doesn't matter. They all confront the problem they have with their kids and their electorate, and they want to solve the problems for their state. And they recognize this is related, as the economist said this morning, to if you want to really raise the bottom of the economic distribution, you have to invest in education there. And so they know this, and so they're more willing to think about this.
But Bill, the politics are just so brutal. I mean, I'm going to be with the governors next week in Philadelphia, and they do get it. They're well-intentioned. They're working hard. But we could have sat here almost 20 years ago after Charlottesville, and people were saying, the governors get it. They came to Charlottesville, and this Governor Clinton, you know, he's going to change things, and he's brought President Bush around, and we're going to have standards. And you know, we saw it was a terribly bloody fight in Washington that is essentially still being fought out now through no
Charlotte. I think it takes somebody in a bully pulpit.
But just
a question, maybe we have to decide
as a country that we
really believe
do need to do this.
We need to do this.
How many states, Bill? It's just a factual question. Actually, keep Secretary of Education in the leadership when there's a change of regime from one part to the other. Because what you really need and what you do have in many of these countries is a disinterested civil service where, you know, it's a profession for them and who is the leadership doesn't fundamentally affect. But if it's politicized and whoever wins gets the spoils, then you're not going to have much progress.
Yeah, it varies. It's not always.
To me, one of those interesting stories is Eli does a prize called the Broad Prize for urban districts. And Long Beach won it, and Long Beach is a finalist this year. Full disclosure, I'm on the review board for it. And they've survived a transition of superintendents, and it's highly unusual to see a high-challenge school district like this be that good in terms of improvement over time and survive a leadership change and not have sort of everything change. And to me, that's right now the most interesting school district in the country to look at just because they've been able to accomplish what we just haven't seen elsewhere.
The biggest reason you have superintendent turnover, school boards. Those school boards often say, we need to change. So they hire a reform superintendent, and within a year or two, this person wants to make a lot of changes. He or she's gone. Now, if you look at places like New York City, before mayoral control, the average tenure was a year and a half. Joel's been there 6 years. Chicago. Paul Vallis was what, there 7, 8 years? Arnie Duncan, 6, 7 years?
Tom Pezant, 10 years.
10 years in
Tom
Boston.
Tom Pezant in Boston, 10
Another
years.
Another Broad Prize winner.
So, Mrs. Brill, will you be mad if I give your husband a kiss? Because I agree with him 100%.
You want to come call the audience?
Yeah, let's get some questions in from the audience. And there's mic runners, so if you'll just put your hands up with the lights, we may not be able to see you, but if you stand up and start talking with the mic, we'll know where you are.
Stand up. Rich.
Okay. I'll start the gentleman back here, and then there's a mic down here. Go ahead, sir.
Great. Hi, my name is Michael Cox. I represent the California Student Sustainability Coalition, and I'm out of Los Angeles. My question is for you, Mr. Broad. The utmost respect and appreciation for your efforts in education. I overviewed everything about the Ed in 08 campaign and Strong American Schools. And my question is about the lack of an incorporation of a green agenda. And was there a strategic decision made to not include anything about greening the school system? I mean, with so much talk about climate and sustainability, it's just absolutely central, and I just would like to know the plans for your efforts going forward in these issues in the education sector.
Well, I believe we've ought to become a green nation, schools included, but we're concentrating on school reform, primarily how do you improve governance, how do you improve management, how do you incentivize people to perform? So we're not especially concentrating on making schools green.
But it's a different kind of green, that's all.
That's true. We believe in green for teachers who perform well, schools that perform well.
Yes, sir, down in front.
Good afternoon. This has been a really stimulating conversation. I would just like to hear, I work in New York City, a community change organization in New York City. I'm involved in several charter schools in Brooklyn as well.
Good.
And I'm terrified about the change of administration in New York and what that will mean for education and the reforms that we've seen over the last, during the Bloomberg administration. And I would just like to hear from the panel what do you think is going to happen in New York and what can we do on the ground in New York to make sure that we don't.
Mayoral control in New York sunsets in June of 2009. Some of us are involved in an effort, starting an effort to make certain that that does not happen, that it continues. I think if we go back to what we had prior to mayoral control, we know what that looked like and we know what it looks like now. I'm delighted with the growth of charter schools in New York City of all sorts, whether it's KIPP Academy. Green Dot, by the way, from Los Angeles is coming and starting a charter school in Harlem with the backing of New York City Teachers Union. We helped Randy Weingarten start two charter schools in Brooklyn and East New York. I think it would be disaster if mayor control ended and we went back to what we had previously.
I think also, though, this shows, I mean, we're still in the early cycle of mayoral control in a lot of these cities, and you still have the mayor. So, for example, in Chicago, you have Daley, relatively the change they made in Boston, and New York, obviously, with what Joel Klein and Michael Bloomberg have done, which I think has driven a lot of progress. And so there's two problems. Eli put his finger on one, which is you could lose mayoral control and go back to the real political dysfunction there. The other one is, though, mayors leave office and mayors change. And so, again, the politics come up. It's not a panacea because you could continue mayoral control and end up with a mayor who's completely hostile to the reforms, and then you're essentially in the same place.
Yeah, part of my question was not only specific to mayoral control generally, but a change of administrations and what the next administration's policies are likely to be.
Of course, you can never know that, but one question you can ask people when they're running is, will you leave the apparatus as it is? And at least then in a democracy, people have that choice. I would do the same thing at a state level, particularly a state that's making some progress. That ought to be a question that's asked of all the candidates.
Because that's the same problem at the state level that you're talking about. Every time I've said I've had the opportunity for the last 10 years to talk to governors, they keep changing every 4 or 8 years. And they go away, and then you start over again in some sense because there's no continuity. It's your point earlier.
If your name is Daley, then the problem disappears.
That's right. Having grown up in Chicago.
Yes, sir. Over here.
You just mentioned unions for the first time in an hour. It seems like it's kind of the elephant in the room. And I guess my question would be, how do we move the NEA and the AFT more toward what you could call a grand education bargain a lot more pay in exchange for a lot more accountability, to move them away from focusing on job security and toward focusing on pay? And how do we change the system so that they recognize that their future lies with that kind of a change in focus?
You've had some modest changes in New York City. They went ahead with incentive comp. The trade-off was greater compensation for teachers. They did away with some of the seniority provisions. They made some modest progress in Denver. We're very hopeful that some dramatic things are going to happen in Washington, D.C. There are a number of labor leaders in America, starting with Andy Stern at SEIU, who are fed up with the way kids are being educated. I hope Andy Stern, when she's elected, next week?
Randy Weingarten in New York.
Randy Weingarten will be, Randy Weingarten will become the second coming of Al Shanker. Al Shanker believed in proficiency testing for veteran teachers. He believed in union-sponsored chartered schools, and believed in certain forms of incentive comp. I think change is in the wind. If you look at Los Angeles, the teachers at Locke High School got so fed up with their regressive teachers union, they bolted. And they went with Green Dot Charter Schools, which has a very thin contract with a professional work day and without all the protections that they had before. Because they want to educate kids, they want safe working conditions, and they want to see progress.
Can I just add real quick? And I'm sorry to jump in, but in many ways, and I appreciate the changes in the wind, but as a mayor who has, and I don't even have mayoral control yet, and the only organized opposition, I've got billboards all over the city from the teachers union attacking me just because I'm willing to just talk about reform and talk about change. And in conversations I have with sort of my mentor in mayoralty, the mayoralty in Bloomberg, spitting fire that the legislature just went down to the radical idea to link a teacher tenure to teacher performance. So the real issue is, and as a Democrat, proud Democrat, who's been attacked by my own party and attacked as a result of standing out on a lot of these issues, is the Democratic Party right now is really still has the union still has a stranglehold over reform and over change, and is systematically throughout the nation right now killing so much of the reform efforts that are going on because Democratic legislators at the state level, as well as Democratic mayors and others, are capitulating to this very, very strong organized lobby throughout our nation.
You hit it on the nail on the head, and my sense is that you might want to change this system really quickly, but it's so incredibly powerful, and part of it is because of your friends in the Democratic Party capitulating to the power. Here's some good news. It's a longer term, but here's some good news. We've looked at the Gen Y teachers, this young group of teachers that are coming in, and they're going to demand a whole different kind of accountability and support from the union. They don't like what's happening. They don't like the way they're being treated in the workforce. They don't like what the union is necessarily promoting for them, and they're going to start demanding different kinds of support from the union.
I'm not so sure about that. We just did a survey of 1,200 teachers nationally, and one of the most striking findings was that among young teachers, you had a 20 percentile point increase over the last 5 years in teachers saying that they felt their teachers' union was absolutely essential.
Not what we found.
Okay, well, was it a...
conflicting data.
Yeah.
But ours was a survey. It actually was it was data of over 1,000 teachers. And what you found was they don't love their union, and they're very frustrated with their unions, but they like the district administration even less, and they have a sense that if something bad happens to them, the unions is the best thing going for them. And so I think, and that's representative of, I mean, Corey put his finger on a problem, but you have to remember this radical change. I mean, this idea that we're orienting the system around performance and student learning and so forth, this is actually a relatively recent phenomenon. There's a lot of people who came into the system under a totally different set of rules and norms and expectations. And so part of what you're seeing in the unions and the struggle, and the struggle that, frankly, you know, progressive leaders like Randy Weingarten face, is there's just a lot of people who this wasn't the bargain for them.
Well, just to add, the hope, I think, is really urban African-American Latino communities who are beginning to see these islands of excellence, like the KIPP schools and the uncommon schools, and a lot of the islands of excellence are beginning to expand
to larger islands of hope for communities. Is this core demographic of the Democratic Party is beginning to truly shift and embrace reform in a way that is going to really have the party caught?
And that's exactly it. That's what I was going to say, is we can try to strike grand bargains and so forth, but ultimately, if it's a problem with legislators, which to some extent it certainly is, sort of we fortunately don't live in an authoritarian state, and that's something citizens can ultimately do something about. And you're starting to see that with some school board elections and people voting with their feet, and I think those kinds of activities, and there's obviously there's an organization called Democrats for Education Reform that Corey's active in that's trying to work on this. And so I think I'm actually optimistic over time. There are some really good people, and again, you know, Randy Weingarten's one of them. But this is a tough issue. You have to remember these are big multi-million member organizations, and so they don't. It's like turning a huge ship. They don't turn very quickly.
But I think as these new reforms come into play, and the new schools and charters and things go up and start demonstrating that they are making a difference, we have to be careful that we don't forget the R&D side and the investment in the research and development. Because when you have a small set of innovative opportunities happening in the system, R&D dollars get confused about where they ought to go, right? And so we have to make sure as we're going forward that we're really continuing to push for the same amount of research and development across the system, not just in these little innovative pockets, but in...
Well, charters even aren't particularly innovative. I'm a big fan of them, but the innovation, to the extent they've been innovative, it's been back office, it's been management and so forth. In terms of the basic technology of teaching and learning, it looks the same as it looks in other schools. They're just more efficient, in many cases, higher performing. You haven't seen that sort of fundamental transformation.
But we need to push the federal government to continue to invest in whether these programs are working and the evaluations that support them.
One other positive note on the union is the AFT, and Randy Weingarten, is very supportive of the notion of national standards, which I think is quite a move for a union to take on that position.
Right. Well, as Eli said, she comes out of that Shanker tradition. Do we have other questions? I see some hands there.
Hi. My name is Sarah, and I'm actually an educator myself. I'm in the classroom almost every day. I do environmental education in this valley.
Thank you.
And I don't know how many of you are teachers yourselves, but we talk about standards and we talk about assessment and all these things, and the research today shows that kids learn the best by doing stuff and getting outside and hands-on in learning. And the teachers are so constrained by the standards that exist in this valley, here in the Roaring Fork Valley, and it's all over the country. My parents are teachers, the same situation. And they're so constrained by standards and assessment that they can't truly feel like they're teaching what they need to be teaching, whether it's character teaching or content or whatever, but they can't get to that because they have to check off all these things, and the kids don't buy into standards because they know it's the checklist. They see it in the classroom. It's on the bulletin board. So I'm wondering, knowing that the research shows how kids learn the best, how are standards and this all these people that make all these decisions about education who aren't necessarily ever even been in a classroom, how do we make it all connect?
I'd like to respond to that. I think
too.
You have to differentiate between two things. You don't want to lump particular standards with the concept of standards. Across the world, virtually all these other countries have standards, and they work very well, and their children learn very well. I mean, the point you're making is perhaps the standards, and I can't speak to them because I don't know them, may be too restrictive, and therefore the standards are in error. Now, we've analyzed the standards for hundreds of districts in all 50 states, and in a general way, they're pretty bad. They're not very good. That's one of the things that I think has to be reformed if we ever hope to achieve the other kinds of reforms, because that's the core of the system. And so I think don't confuse those two things. And then don't confuse the assessments with the concept of assessment. Most assessments are not very good. State assessments are really not very good. And therefore, and this is where I agree with what something Howard said earlier, you know, we need better assessments. Teaching to the test isn't bad if it's done in a way that's sensible. And in much of Europe and that, they have a set of standards, and then every year there's a different test, and they don't even test all the areas. They don't try to have items on every little item that's covered in the curriculum. And therefore, kids know they've got to know the stuff completely, because they don't know what they're going to be tested on. So there are ways to do what you want to have done. And there's not really a lot of research that says children learn best by doing that, what you suggested. I mean, that's... There's... that if you really look at the data there, the data are not really supportive of such a strong statement. That's a misinterpretation of a lot of data. You don't have to have a practical application to everything in order for children to learn it. It's just not supported by the data.
Howard, do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, no, possibly more than other people in the panel, I feel your pain. But I want to talk about the conversation I had yesterday with Sean Goodman, because I think it's really very interesting. He has this very mixed class, which is more and more the story in large parts of America and Europe as well, and he teaches history. And, you know, history, American history, you're supposed to know certain things if you're going to be tested on an advanced placement test or an achievement test. And yet he finds that except for the students who are bent on going to the top colleges, there's no interest, and it's like pulling teeth. And so we talked a bit about what are the students interested in. And, you know, there was a lot of interest in race, because the students grouped by race. There was some interest in civil rights, and perhaps a little interest in Iraq. And so we talked about the possibility, I'm not going to put this in his mouth because it's my idea, about starting with those interests. And then the word I used was backfilling. Namely, if you're really interested in why we're grouping by race, you might want to know what was said
the history,
you know, 50 years ago with Brown versus right. Board and go backwards. Similarly, you know, everybody now agrees Iraq is a mess. Did we ever do anything like this before? Oh, have you ever heard of Vietnam? Now, this is obviously starting with student interests, developing projects which begin there, but begin to open something not only about the past, but about the whole reason which you study history, which is to have some illumination about what's going on now. Then I suggested, you know, for the kids who are college bound, get a good textbook, and if they want to go back and read about, you know, the stuff which they're going to be tested on, fine. But I think what you're describing is because we have a fairly limited... understanding both among the policymakers and among too many teachers, we get a lowest common denominator kind of thing. And that's why I said that I thought that ultimately, if 30 years or 40 years from now, we have a good educational system. It may well be because we have common approaches to literacy and numeracy, but because what's special about America and the experimentation, and people learning from experiments, and people being excited enough to go into teaching, and even unions turning around, I think that's how it's going to happen. It's not going to happen by people who may be well-meaning, as the people who came up with No Child Left Behind, sitting in the Senate and trying to figure out how to regulate the country. Remember the Jesse test. Remember the Japan example. Remember why all of our forefathers came to this country, but why now it's harder to come here in every single way. That's, to me, the ultimate answer. That's why I think Tom Friedman's new book about how do we deal with the green, how do we deal with crowdedness, and how do we deal with flatness is, I think, where America has to take the lead.
Well, so, hang on. Willing to wait 30 years for this? You're willing to wait 30 more years for this?
Well, I think it's going to take 30 years, but you got to start now. That's where
I want to
realize impatience.
30 years is irrelevant. I want to interject a more immediate point. There's a class element to this discussion. I don't think most of the people in this room and most of the people at this conference would wait 30 hours for their children to be able to do the kind of work
exactly right.
that we're expecting. There's a problem here. These tests, I mean, they're low quality, and Bill got into it, and a lot of the standards aren't very good and so forth, but they're really low level, and good teachers and good schools should be getting kids over them very fast. And when you see, and I see this in Virginia, you watch good teachers and how they can engage kids. These things are not in opposition, and so we need to do better with it. The tests need to be better in the accountability systems. But this idea that sort of engaging kids, getting them outside, giving them projects and so forth, some of the things Howard was talking about, and having them do well on some sorts of standardized measurements are somehow, you know, at odds with one another. It's simply not the case. And the people who are in the sort of decision-making role, the elite roles, would never tolerate sending their child to a school that wasn't just, you know, knocking the cover off the ball with regard to these relatively low tests. And I think that gets lost. It's a problem that's visited on the most vulnerable amongst us. Other questions?
Hi, my name is Rufus Williams. I happen to be an appointed president of a school board. that was mentioned a few times.
Okay, Eli's going to answer your question.
Happens to be Chicago. Also note my the vice president of the board is also here. But in all the conversations that have taken place, there are some things that I totally support a national standard. But the issue that has not been addressed is the resources to get children to the same place so that when you find that we're not there, how do you get them there? And that conversation about funding is one that is truly critical for most large urban cities and certainly for ours. As you talk about the governors getting it, you know, I suspect that in most places, just like in Chicago, you've got a number of different types of public school systems that are different within the state. So the mayor is getting it, I think, is much more critical because they are the ones who are on the front line and very, very more readily involved in what's taking place for their constituencies there. I also think that we have to address the issue of early childhood and the fact that we're all born, all men are created equal, but then we immediately start doing different things. So by the time a child gets to kindergarten, they are very different learning, so we may have the standards, but if we don't put the resources in to really make that happen at the earliest point, then we don't really get the progress that we hope to get.
The finance questions, and most states paradoxically have systems that send more money to affluent communities and less money to low-income communities. So
there's no question education needs more money, but just spending it the same way we've been spending it is not going to get us there. Early childhood, universal early childhood education is a must. Some states are going to get there sooner than others. We all have to get there.
It costs more, I think most people would agree, and research, it costs more to educate low-income kids, educate kids who are at risk. Is this country, right, we talk about equal funding. What we really need to be talking about is equitable funding, which means sending unequal more to those who have less. Is the country ready for that?
I think so. It's even worse than that. In a school district like Los Angeles and many school districts, they have what they call salary averaging, which means they average all these teacher salaries. And you know what happens with the seniority provisions? A teacher with seniority can decide where they want to teach and what they want to teach. So guess what kind of a teacher they get in the inner city? A rookie teacher, the least teaching experience, lowest pay.
Well, let me add to that. I mean, when you talk about it costing more to educate a low-income student, it costs more not to educate them because we know what happens on the other side.
Absolutely.
But, and I also I can't miss the fact that in Chicago we also do, and thank you so much, Eli Broad, for sending us so many Broad residents because they do truly help move our system. And we also have a vast number of Teach for America students there as well. So the studies are showing that we are moving the bar, but at the same time the funding issue is really big because we also have the shortest school day and shortest school year in the nation. So while we can make progress, we can't make but so much without the resources to do more.
But one of the things Arnie is doing is looking at how to reallocate some of the resources in ways that make bigger difference. So that's another credit to sort of longer-term superintendent that's had the opportunity to look across the years and really look at the system and make some changes.
But you teased me about 30 years, but it's been 20 years since Bill Bennett made his statement. And I think Chicago is better, but it is a long, hard, and that's what our president has to tell us about everything, and especially about energy and about green.
Yes.
These
I
are not things.
CPS
we start today,
perfect.
But we have to have a sense about these things take a lot of time, and you can't lose heart because it takes time.
I think you can settle for 30 years, Howard.
And I hate to be the cynic. I'm usually where Bill is being the optimist, but I hear how it costs more to put children in prison than educate them. That's very true, and I completely agree. But then I look at how we do school finance, and sort of we can talk about this, but then if you look at the choices people make at the ballot box and the choices policymakers, we don't honor that by the way we do school finance in the state. So it makes me a little bit cynical. We have time for one more question down here in front.
Just more, and
there's a mic runner coming.
An affirmative comment to the issue of resources that this gentleman put forward. We spend $30,000 per year for our students in an independent school environment. I was a superintendent of a public school system for 10 years. We were spending then $4,800, so let's bring it up to $8,000. There is no way that you can be educating kids of means and of background at $30,000 a year and not doing it at $8,000 a year for the others?
Well, please join me in I hate to end on such a pessimistic note, because I think you did hear some very optimistic comments about the direction we're going in meeting this challenge. Please join me in thanking our panelists.